What's on the horizon for financial markets? At PGIM, it's a question that over 1,400 investment professionals relentlessly research in pursuit of your long-term goals. Specialized across asset classes, but united in collaboration, our teams provide global and local expertise. Our investments shape tomorrow, today. Pursue your tomorrow with PGIM, a leading global asset manager.
You're listening to The Exchange. Here's today's show.
Thank you, Scott. I'm Deirdre Bosa, in for Kelly Evans, and here is what ahead. Big banks and energy are in focus today. Our market guest is bullish on both, but he sees a less than rosy picture for the broader market for the next decade. He is here to tell us why. Plus, Fox CEO Aaron Levy joins me right here on set. He sees AI as a job creator, a content aggregator, and a productivity booster, but he is warning of one thing that could get in the way. And you know him from Shark Tank or his investments across media, tech, and entertainment. RSE Ventures' Matt Higgins is also here. And fresh off my interview with former WeWork CEO Adam Neumann, I will ask him if he would invest in Adam's new venture. But we begin with today's markets and Dom Chu with the numbers. Dom, we are drifting very close to those session lows.
Just about there right now, Dee, to your point. It's been deteriorating throughout the course of the last couple of hours here. And as Deirdre points out, session lows right now. I'll take you through the broader cap S&P 500 right now, which is down 75, 76 points, down 1.5% overall at 51.23. So again, this is the session low right now. We were still down 24 points, even at the session highs. So that gives you an idea of kind of how far we've drifted lower to the downside here. And by the way, the level that a lot of traders are watching right now in the S&P 500 is 51.11. That represents the so-called 50-day moving average of the S&P 500, the kind of more medium-term trend line. So keep an eye on those levels. The NASDAQ composite really pacing the declines here, down 270 points, 1.5% decline, 16,171 for the composite. The Dow Industrials down 471 points, 1.25% to 37,988. Now, one of the big focal points that we're dealing with right now is in the energy trade. Believe it or not, every sector in the S&P 500 is lower right now, but energy is actually outperforming. It's only down about 0.5%. The energy sector spidered. The reason why this is important is over the course of this year, the energy sector is still the second best performing sector in the S&P 500 next to communication services. So we'll see whether or not that broadening trade still has some legs. Energy on that value side of things, something to watch. And analysts at Morgan Stanley have already called the sector a attractive. They upgraded that kind of target for them. So keep an eye on that. And then big bank earnings season kicks off. These stocks have had a monster run for the most part over the course of the last 6 months or so. But JP Morgan Chase is now down 6.5%, one of the real drags on the Dow so far today. Wells Fargo and Citigroup all each lower on the back of their earnings reports, which were, by the way, all generally positive, besides for some concerns about net interest income. BlackRock, the world's largest asset manager, also out with better than expected quarterly results, but it's down 2% right now. Deirdre, BlackRock, interesting, biggest asset manager. It now manages just around $10.5 trillion, yes, with a T, in assets under management. Something to watch, all something's
back. Absolutely. We heard from CEO Larry Fink today, so his comments all the more important because of how important that company is. Dom, thank you. My next guest manages a five-star fund with energy and financials among its top holdings. Good time for that. And while he is extra bullish on some particular names, he sees a bumpy road ahead for broader markets, expecting zero on the S&P over the next 10 years. Joining me for more now is Cole Smead, president and CEO at Smead Capital. Thanks for being with us, Cole. Explain what you mean by that. Are we about to enter a completely lost decade for equities?
Yeah, the answer is yes, nominally. But the real danger for most investors, whether it be institutional or individual retirees, let's just say, is that the real returns are going to be worse. Okay, just to give you an analogous period, we think a lot, 2021 was like 1969. Today looks a lot like 1972. But regardless of whether those paradigms are perfectly identical, you went into a lost decade in that case where investors made almost 6% in the S&P 500, but they lost 4 to 5% real. If you look at the 2000s, they lost money nominally. It looks more like, today, in my opinion, from a nominal return perspective, but they lost real money. Okay, so I just point that out because when we say that to people, listen, the S&P might make zero, plausibly would make zero in our minds. We're using the St. Louis Fed data, which they call the FRED data. That's equities as a percentage of U.S. household financial assets. The data just argues that when American households have a large portion of their net worth of financial assets in stocks, the forward returns are very poor. And like I said, this is higher than 99. That was a negative one. So I might be being bullish when I say zero.
That is an extremely dire picture, Cole, because that is, you know, the stock market, the S&P 500, is a wealth generator in our country. Where does the average person get a return? Is it the property market, which we know is under pressure as well? What's the average person to do here?
Yeah. The question is, should the average person get rewarded, or should the broadly diversified investor get rewarded? Because in those prior areas, they didn't. And I think the real myth that we're going to bust is that everyone's going to participate in the stock market, yeah, and they're all going to do just wonderfully so. Okay, we don't. There's a lot of areas where you see stock market failure left and right. So I would argue, to your point, the S&P 500 looks very unattractive from a 10-year forward perspective. Now, as you noted a second ago, we have 5% in cash. We're almost fully invested out there. So it's not like we're sitting there hoarding cash, because we're just saying the composition of the S&P 500 is going to be painful. But as the S&P owns 4% in energy, we're making good money in the energy business, and it seems to be that the large institutions and passive owners just don't care, some by rule and some by choice. And, you know, like Buffett said many years ago, the secret to life is weak competition. Think about it like this. As value stock pickers, we got to beat zero. I like my odds.
It's a provocative thought. And over the last 10 years, you could have been distracted by a bunch of things. But if you held tech, the growthiest part of the market, and the mega caps in particular, you would have done very well. And right now, there's a thesis that many people share that artificial intelligence is going to underpin gains for the next decade plus. Do you completely disagree with that?
Well, no. See, I think where people are wrong is if you look at the forward adoption of technology, you'll see unit volumes go way up. And we fully expect AI will. But what do you see price per unit? It declines. You know, if you just look out at businesses in those spaces, in the long run, as the technology grows, margins decline with it. Okay, and so I just point that out because I look at AI. It's like it'd be like when the tractor came about. It's wonderful technology. We were going to greatly revolutionize agriculture in that case. Or if you were the caveman, you figured out the hammer. It's a wonderful tool, but again, it's going to be widely adopted. And as units grow, the price per unit will decline. I think people are actually looking at this and saying the early units are going to give us the low indication of price on these goods. I don't think that's going to hold true, just like it didn't for the internet, right? We adopted the internet widely. Look at the cost of a smartphone. A billionaire could not have that in 1980 or 1990, for that matter.
I need to question you on this. So you don't think the gains made in artificial intelligence are going to be reflected in technology stocks? Is that what you're saying?
No, I'm saying that the predictions of profitability off of those are likely to be underwhelming. In other words, just to get to where the expectations are right now, they have to do miraculously and marvelous things. If I was going to give you the 2021 example of this, it was DocuSign. Miraculous, marvelous, and by the way, didn't end up being what the analysts wrote up. And so I would just very caution people. I said this was like 1972. This is the creme de la creme of blue chip American companies, and it is as overpriced as it gets, like Coca-Cola was, like Disney was, like the blue chips of the past.
The technology companies are some of the most profitable companies. They're sitting on gigantic cash piles. You think that banks over the next 10 years is a better investment than some of these giant mega cap names because they're overvalued? Is that right?
Well, by the way, I mentioned the Nifty 50 a second ago. They had great balance sheets. They had beautiful profits. Didn't save them either. Okay. But let me add one more thing, Deirdre, on that. Yeah. Everyone is a long-term investor at the top of markets. Back to your average investor. They're all long-term right now. At the bottom of markets, you can't find long-term investors. That's the problem with humans. That's the reality of the situation. And I don't care how many books Daniel Kahneman wrote, we're not going to fix that problem. But people believe we have. Huh. So back to your point on the banks. Here's the great part about the banks. Do I know about trouble in the last 12 to 18 months in the banks? Yes, that has been priced in more so. If you look at the bank reports today, the banks that benefited from deposit flows a year ago are the ones that are having a little bit of a tougher time holding net interest margins, because those deposits, unless lent out at a higher rate, aren't going to help you. So they've taken on a bunch of deposit costs, but they don't have a lending window opening to cause them to be able to go out and earn money on that. So, you know, we've owned JP Morgan and Bank of America for a very long time, in both those cases over 10 years. We got involved with the regional banks last fall because if we can buy mid-teens return banks and they're trading for below book, You know, okay. Do we have a plausible outcome to make good money?
So it's a valuation thesis, it sounds like. Cole, I wish we had more time. Very interesting thesis. We'll leave it there for now. Cole Smead.
Yeah, appreciate it.
Let's turn to the other side of finance. Bitcoin has risen over 50% since spot Bitcoin ETFs began trading. Our next guest says increased crypto volumes could help Coinbase. He raised his price target by $61 today, but he still has an underperform rating on the stock. Joining me now is Dan Dolev, Managing Director at Mizuho. Dan, it's hey. So nice to see you in person.
Welcome to the East Coast.
I think I last saw you on the West Coast. Longer term, let's start with Bitcoin as a whole.
Yes.
Does it behave like a growth stock or a store of value? That's really it, like the crux of it. And so far, we've seen it acting like the latter, right?
Right. I mean, right now it's doing well, but I still think that longer term it has no yield support.
Right.
It's basically just FOMO. And I think eventually it's going to go down. I think eventually this is going to unravel that there's
Bitcoin
really nothing
as
there.
A whole.
Bitcoin, yeah.
There's How low does
there.
It go?
I mean, I see no value in it personally, so it probably goes back to like the 40s or 30s easily.
Oh, 40s or 30s is only, yeah. It's not as bad as below 20.
It could get there too.
Okay.
Next ice age.
So then tell me about Coinbase, your call today.
Yeah, so the call today is basically, look, I mean, volumes have been strong. I mean, we said that the hodlers have won. They won Q1. So the volumes were just so strong. Consensus is underestimating, you know, what they're going to put out in terms of revenue by 40%. We had to take up our, you know, revenue estimates and EBITDA. And just to be fair, we had to take up our price target. But we still see massive downside from where the stock trades today.
Right, which is your broader thesis that Bitcoin Correct. Eventually goes.
Bitcoin goes lower,
down. Yeah.
Interest fades and, you know, take rates, which is kind of what they earn.
Yeah.
Are going to come down with competition.
It feels like we've been talking forever about how Coinbase has been trying to diversify its business. How successful or not successful have they been in the last 12 months?
Not really, right? So it's basically still just, you know, Bitcoin and also all these altcoins, all these like, you know, yield supporting businesses are not really taking off, you know, whether it's staking, et cetera, those remain very small and insignificant.
Okay, let me just ask you because your take on Bitcoin is interesting. Gold then, do you believe gold will continue to go higher?
I mean,
that
it's
is
been
the
around.
Store of value?
Yeah, that's probably been around. I mean, I personally believe more in real estate. You had Adam Newman yesterday here. It's probably a better call. But yeah, I guess gold, I mean, we're used to it. People can, you know, there's, you know, we have like a predisposition to like it. I think Bitcoin is right now purely driven by FOMO.
Okay. Bank earnings, because we saw in this morning's earnings from JP Morgan and some others, some weakness in deposits. Good overall, but at least the beginnings of some weaknesses in deposits. Customers are shifting out of zero to low interest rate checking and savings account into higher yielding products like CDs. But you and I talk all the time about the fintech companies. You've got SoFi, you've got Robinhood, a number of other ones offering way higher APYs, even my Apple savings account.
Correct.
I think it's 4.5% now. Are they benefiting?
They're benefiting, and I think like specifically on SoFi, which is the bank that I cover, what they're going to do this year, again, my bet, they said that they're not going to grow personal loans. They're going to actually do the opposite and boost personal loans. The stock's going to rip. So they're getting massive deposits. They're giving you $2 million of insurance. They're getting a lot of people coming in, and they're going to offer these people personal loans. That's what makes SoFi such a good idea.
And is that in relation to more regulation coming down the pike for the big banks? Is their win sort of a loss for the bigger banks?
I think their win is the loss of the big 100%, absolutely, because people don't need to go into the branch. And SoFi offers kind of no branch banking, and they have a great brand. They've got this, you know, the stadium. What's not to like?
Right. But historically in the stock market, right, they still have a lot of ground to make. A lot of these fintech names haven't lived up to those promises.
Correct.
So what is that reflected in their stock price? What's going to be the catalyst, what you just said?
So I think the catalyst, yeah, it's a great question. I think right now the stock is really depressed. I think it's $7. I have a $12 price target. What's going to happen? Again, I don't know. But if they actually boost personal loan growth and extend more loans, even though they said they're not going to do it, that's going to create up to 10% upside to consensus revenue and 20 to 25% upside to profitability. That's the catalyst.
Talk about those profit margins, though, because when you offer, you know, 4.5 or 5% APY, that eats into those margins, which is what the big banks have over the fintechs. Do we see more profitable fintechs? Or do they lower those rates?
No, I actually think that I think for SoFi specifically, when they issue or when they originate a personal loan, they get paid immediately like 5-6% on the loan. So they get, you know, $2,000. They make $2,000 on a $30,000 loan immediately. And that's what makes the profit so rich.
Interesting. So that could be a theme for the rest of the year. We'll keep an eye on. Dan Dolev, thank you for coming in.
Thank you.
Appreciate it. Dan Dolev, Mizuho. Coming up, it's the age-old question. Will artificial intelligence cut jobs or create them? Box co-founder and CEO Aaron Levy is here to make his case for job growth with one major warning for corporate America. And from AI to VC, venture capitalist and Shark Tank judge, guest judge Matt Higgins has a billion-dollar portfolio spanning nearly every sector in the market. He's going to join us with where he sees the most risk and the most opportunity and how higher rates are playing into his investing strategy. Before we head to break, here is another check on the market. Stocks are still near session lows. The Dow was down 515 points earlier. It's down less than 500 now. The NASDAQ composite, still the laggard here, down 1.6%. Keep an eye on the sell-off. Exchange is back right after this.
This is The Exchange on CNBC.
This episode is brought to you by AARP. 10 years from today, Lisa Schneider will trade in her office job to become the leader of a pack of dogs. As the owner of her own dog rescue, that is. A second act made possible by the reskilling courses Lisa's taking now with AARP to help make sure her income lives as long as she does. And she can finally run with the big dogs. And the small dogs, who just think they're big dogs. That's why the younger you are, the more you need AARP. Learn more at aarp.org/skills.
Electricity, a big idea that's inspired countless new ones. From powering the light bulb to virtually powering our entire lives. 30 years ago, State Street launched the Spider S&P 500 ETF, SPY. A big idea that inspired the world to invest differently. And still does. What can you do with SPY?
Before investing, consider the fund's investment objectives, risks, charges, and expenses. Visit SSGA.com for a prospectus containing this and other information. Read it carefully before investing. SPY is subject to risks similar to those of stocks. All ETFs are subject to risk, including possible loss of principal. Alps Distributors, Inc. Distributor.
Welcome back to The Exchange. Not even a fall of 10% from its highs was able to slow NVIDIA shares this week. The chipmaker slumping into correction territory on Wednesday. But shares, they're still up by nearly 2% week to date. It has even managed to outperform Intel and Meta, both making in-house AI chip announcements this week, and both are on track to end the week in the red. Our next guest is also going all in on AI. His company just crossed $1 billion in annual revenue and still says there's a lot more opportunity ahead. For more, we're joined by Aaron Levy, CEO and co-founder of Box. Aaron, thank you for making the trip.
Hey, thanks for having me. So
you have been in D.C.
Yes.
This week, right?
Yeah.
And you often talk to the regulators about sort of plans for AI. Obviously, you're as excited about anyone as the possibilities and the opportunity.
Yeah.
What is the risk of regulation? What did they tell you this week? Are you more or less optimistic that our own regulators have the right tools and the right aims here?
Yeah. So most of the conversations were with Congress. Obviously, you know, those in Congress trying to figure out where do we take AI regulation and what are the possible laws that we need to enact. Let me just TLDR it first. I'm actually very optimistic based on the conversations that I was involved in this week. I think we have a Congress that, while obviously in many dimensions of it can be dysfunctional, I think there's a lot of productive conversation happening around AI and one that is actually taking a very optimistic tone. The conversations were about the improvements in healthcare, in logistics, and education that AI can offer. Mm-hmm. And so there's a sort of general understanding that you don't want to over clamp down on this. You don't want to overregulate to the point where you could actually limit the progress that we can now see with AI. So I think it's actually a really great time to be having this conversation. It's very productive dialogue. And I'm optimistic that we will not see sort of overregulation in this space right now.
And we've talked about this in the past, the idea that regulation should be handed down by, you know, Washington itself, or you let industries regulate themselves, like you have a regulator in the financial services industry, et cetera. Are you optimistic that it will roll out that way, or that you're going to get Congress people sort of trying to hand down blanket regulation?
I think the general momentum, is increasingly that there's a lot of regulation already on the books around how we should deal with financial services and how we should deal with logistics and how we should deal with transportation. Mm-hmm. And that each of those agencies and the regulators around those industries are in a better position to understand the impact of AI than having some wholesale regulation about AI generally. I think the risk that we were starting to talk about last year that I was very nervous about is sort of wholesale regulation on AI, which is, you know, we have to limit the performance of these models. We have to limit how many GPUs you can have in a cluster. That made no sense because right. we're way too early in the technology curve to be slowing down the rate of progress in AI right now.
You and I have talked a lot about the idea of job creation yeah. and AI or job loss. I want to play a soundbite for you from Larry Fink okay. this morning, and I'll get you to respond on the back.
They're going to create new jobs, too. Think about all the needs for building out data centers and management. It's going to reshape our jobs. Let's be clear. Think about all the jobs that have been lost in society, whether telephone operators, yeah. even from, you know, there's so many jobs that have been eliminated, but we have, we're at 3.7 unemployment. Over time, we create new jobs. And, you know, unfortunately, there's a timing differential. And in many cases, a geographic differential.
So a lot of people, when they think about AI, they hear either new jobs yeah. or they hear a loss of jobs,
yeah.
job destruction.
Yeah.
I think the most important word he said was reshape,
yeah.
right? It's going to be different. This is something that you've talked about. When do we get that? Because it feels like even at the beginning of this year, we've seen even white-collar jobs, a lot of jobs lost at the likes of Google and Duolingo and some other tech companies. So how do you think that yeah. this evolves?
Well, to be clear, those jobs that maybe were lost really had nothing to do with AI.
Duolingo, for example, did call out.
Well, there might be AI that is sort of disruptive to a particular product that a company is offering, which could cause them to maybe not need as much. There might not be as much demand for a service. I'm not as familiar with that particular cut, but in general, the losses of the past year or so. We're just companies that honestly overhired for the growth rates. I think the real impact of AI, it's actually almost better to think about it at a micro basis than a macro basis. Because the macro basis, you sort of say, how many people are in this particular part of labor and what happens to those jobs if AI kind of ran through it? It's actually better to look at it at more of a company level. If a company could make their salespeople more productive or their engineers more productive, then what's going to happen is those companies will actually have a greater demand for the services of those salespeople or those engineers. If I could make, you know, every salesperson inside of an organization 10% more productive, which means they can sell, you know, 10% more in terms of services for the same cost, we're going to hire more salespeople. We're not going to hire fewer salespeople. So when AI is actually used as a co-pilot or a way of augmenting the capabilities of an employee, you're going to actually see that the productivity of that particular function goes up,
right.
which means the demand for it will go up. There might be some movement of jobs in that process, you know, in different parts of labor, but on a general basis, productivity, you know, almost always inevitably creates more jobs in the economy.
Right. So net new jobs eventually, at least.
Net new jobs, and even the ones that are in current kind of classified domains that you already are investing in.
Last question for you.
Yeah.
As CEO of Box, you work with all the hyperscalers and you see what they're developing. And one of the big themes we talk about at CNBC these days is the role of Google, right? And the innovator's dilemma that it is facing right now. Does it disrupt search in order to provide more generative AI to its customers?
Yeah.
Or does it hold on to search, its cash
yeah.
cow? What's your view?
I think, first of all, Google is in a position where they really have to kind of drive an evolution and a transition of the user base over time from the sort of, you know, typing in a single query into a search box to typing in a question and getting either a set of answers or decisions or even actions that Google's taking. That will take some time because even us as consumers are taking some time to adapt to this new technology. I think Google's in an incredibly strong spot to drive that transition. And then as a technology provider in the AI sort of hyperscaler cloud infrastructure wars, they're an incredible partner as well. So with Box, we have a service called Box AI. We connect to different models from different AI providers, including OpenAI and Google, and we find their technology to be extremely strong. Our customers are clamoring for these types of use cases around how do they work with their data. Google is one of our strongest partners in this space.
So basically, do not count them out.
Absolutely not. It would be a mistake.
Yeah. Aaron, thank you so much for coming in
cool.
spending
thank
time
you.
With us. Aaron Levy, CEO of Box. Let's get a quick check on stocks. They are at session lows at the moment. The S&P 500 is down 1.6%. Losses in the NASDAQ have accelerated as well. Tech very weak today, down 1.8%. And we've got a news alert on an upcoming IPO. Leslie Picker has the story. Leslie.
Hey, Deirdre. It's our sweet spot here. IPOs. StubHub, I'm told, is working with advisors
to go public this summer. That's according to a person familiar with the matter and confirms an earlier report by The Information. I'm told the company is aiming for a valuation that surpasses their latest private round from 2021. That was $16.5 billion. So that would be quite the jump for CEO Eric Baker, who co-founded the company about 24 years ago, then sold it to eBay in 2007, only to buy it back for $4 billion. In 2020 through another company he founded via GoGo. StubHub declined to comment on plans to go public, but this would support some of the commentary we heard this morning on the bank earnings calls today about expectations for 2Q IPOs. Most executives actually seemed encouraged by this market loosening up even further from here after Astera Labs and Reddit debuted in late March. So all of that seems to be boding well for a revival of this IPO market that's been historically dormant.
I can hear the investment bankers, Leslie, saying, see, we told you the window is open. Certainly, we've seen more activity and looks like there's more to come. Thank you. Mm-hmm. Still ahead, consumer spending bouncing back for a second straight month. So what does it say about the long-awaited slowdown? We will bring you the latest numbers when we come back.
This episode is brought to you by AARP. 10 years from today, Lisa Schneider will trade in her office job to become the leader of a pack of dogs. As the owner of her own dog rescue, that is. A second act made possible by the reskilling courses Lisa's taking now with AARP to help make sure her income lives as long as she does. And she can finally run with the big dogs. And the small dogs, who just think they're big dogs. That's why the younger you are, the more you need AARP. Learn more at aarp.org/skills.
Good afternoon. I'm Tyler Matheson with your CNBC News update at this hour. It just got a whole lot more expensive to get an oil and gas lease on federal land. The Biden administration today raised prices for the first time since 1960. The original fee, $10,000 a lease, will now be $150,000 per lease and will require royalties to be paid for extracted oil and gas. The White House says the fees will provide more money for taxpayers and protect them against any environmental cleanup costs. Johnson Controls has agreed to pay a $750 million settlement with some U.S. public water utilities over its use of, quote, forever chemicals used in some of its products. The company said the settlement did not mean it acknowledged any wrongdoing of its subsidiary, Tyco Fire Products. Last year, lawsuits over forever chemicals resulted in more than $11 billion in settlements. And Kentucky University, that is, of today hired alumnus and BYU head coach Mark Pope as its new men's basketball coach. Pope will succeed the legendary John Calipari, who stepped down after 15 seasons to go over to another SEC school in Arkansas. Back to you.
Thank you very much, Tyler. See you soon. WeWork founder Adam Neumann, he's ready for his second act, and this time around he is focusing on connecting people not through communal workspaces, but through community living spaces with his new venture, Flow. The company and its apartment buildings in Fort Lauderdale in Miami, they launched yesterday. I sat down with him to discuss that and whether founders can turn things around after failure.
I am the kind of person that actually learns more from their mistakes than from their successes. So all the great things we did in the past, we're going to do again. But then I had time to reflect, for example, partners. I'm so grateful and lucky to have Mark Andreessen and Ben Horowitz from A16Z as my partners.
Worth noting that those partners have invested $350 million into Neumann and Flow to date. My next guest is a VC who also believes in second chances, as long as you don't make the same mistake twice. Joining me now is Matt Higgins, co-founder and CEO of RSE Ventures. Matt, thank you for coming in.
Thanks for having me.
That as well. So what you heard from Adam Neumann there, and maybe some more of the interview from yesterday, do you believe it? Do you think that he's learned lessons from WeWork that can make him successful in his next venture?
Well, he certainly learned the right talking points, right? In my world, you always look for second-time founders. Right. Second-time founders over-index on performance. I teach at Harvard Business School, and one of the topics that students are always interested in is how do you rebound from failure? Right. And the answer is self-awareness. So I think, actually, he exhibited a lot of self-awareness in that interview. He's got the right investors. He was talking about how our board meetings are now active, go figure, mm-hmm. and that he's getting asked a lot of tough questions, and everybody's holding him accountable. Yeah. I didn't write a check into it, and it's not a judgment, but I think it makes sense to give him another shot.
So another way of looking at this, which I do often, is cult of the founder. How much, you know, especially Silicon Valley's and VCs, and I usually sit in San Francisco, want to believe in founders that sometimes they ignore some red flags. How do you know which one you're looking at, whether someone is genuine or whether a founder, you know, hasn't learned from those mistakes, but investors just so badly want to believe in the story?
It's amazing how much investors don't spend a lot of time trying to analyze the human. I use industrial psychologists, believe it, all the time to figure out whether or not the founder has evolved. Do they over-index for self-awareness? The Italians have a great phrase, the fish rots from the head. So the answer is look under the hood, and you're not going to find the answers on a spreadsheet. So you look, do they use the word I all the time?
Right.
Or have they discovered the word we? There's a lot of little signals that you could look for that VCs really aren't taught, investors aren't taught. So the reality is I think he probably has learned his lesson and probably has a lot of fight in him that he might not have had before.
Right. In terms of due diligence, though, right, always important to look at the business model. And in this sense, you know, one of the things I questioned him on yesterday is this a real estate startup or a tech startup, right? And he even brought up an interesting point. What's Tesla, a car company or a technology company? How do you look at that? Companies now, especially in the age of AI, trying to AI wash, let's call it, or put an AI wrapper on things versus, you know, they're really doing work in that area.
So you just hit on an amazing signal. If you think about his S1 that he put out during WeWork, in which he got annihilated, it was because he tried to turn everything into it's a tech. He used it the word like a million times. So I hope, God willing, he's not trying to frame this as anything other than what he is. Stay away from hyperbole and prove what you got this time around.
Great point. And he did talk about the real estate side of that business a lot. Matt, stay with us. With inflation proving stickier than expected, markets have been closely monitoring economic data to predict the Fed's next move. And now even Silicon Valley is starting to do the same. Let's get over to Kate Rooney for more. Kate, I love this story so much because a lot of VCs don't even want to talk interest rates. The smartest ones do, though.
Exactly, Devo. You know what it's like on Sand Hill Road. I spent a little time there this week. It is the epicenter of venture. The Fed does really seem to be in focus again. CPI did catch the attention of a few folks I talked to. One person told me they're now checking things like oil prices. You don't see that every day to see what it means for the Fed. One big impact for these venture investors, the IPO window, it's still seen as pretty tough and a tough time to go public. That is really how these private investors cash out and then return money to their investors. So endowments, pension funds, for example, many are watching Rubrik, that upcoming software IPO, as one bellwether. Multiples were slashed dramatically, really, when the Fed started tightening. A lot of people have already, quote, taken the pill, as one investor told me, so found more cost discipline. Jack Abraham, for example, of Atomic, telling me all of this affects the sentiment of limited partners, those LPs, and how much they are going to have to invest back into those venture funds. And if a pension can get a risk-free 5% on a treasury bill, that make venture a little less enticing. Tiger Global has really been the cautionary tale people talk about, reportedly raised about $2 billion for its latest fund. Sounds like a big number, but it's a third of the $6 billion it was going for. It raised a $12 billion fund back at the peak of zero interest rates, the ZIRP era, as people sometimes call it. All of this has an impact on where they're going to spend. One person described it as a tale of two cities. You got AI town, as you've been talking about, D. It's booming. While some of the rate-sensitive towns, fintech, real estate, not doing as well. You also mentioned AI washing, D. I heard a lot about that. One investor recently told me that they are telling their portfolio companies to add .AI if they cannot go out there and raise money. So you're seeing some of those strategies pop up.
So replace the .ETH, .ETF with .AI.
Exactly. That was the big crypto move for a while. It's like absolutely deja vu from the crypto bubble.
Kate, thank you very much. Matt, Kate alluded to the ZIRP era, right, where the discounted cash flow made, you didn't have to change it very much because interest rates were at near zero. We're obviously in a very different time. How much are you now looking at where interest rates are to make your investments in value portfolio companies?
Yeah, I think the interesting part is now the VC market is a leading indicator of what's going to happen in this country. The VC market is entirely
not lagging anymore.
Not literally. Before it was leading. Yeah. Tiger Capital putting money to work all over the place. Why not? No. Now it's leading. It is is still seized up. There's a huge disconnect between public markets where you're getting these crazy forward multiples of 21 times, right? And then in the VC side, people are not putting money to work and they're not falling for the hustle anymore. Putting .ai at the end is not going to work you're talking to people who don't know what they're talking about. So the reality is the VC market is totally seized up ahead of the public markets and they're going to converge. But this time they figured out money is not being thrown out and a lot of companies are going to die over the next 12 months.
Well, what about, there's particular companies in the AI space, like an Anthropic, like an OpenAI, their valuations are through the roof, right? These are more of the foundational models with a lot of the AI researchers and talent at those companies. Do you think those are overvalued?
I think they are overvalued. I think a lot of the things that went out the door quickly, let's look at ARM as an example, right? ARM, for example, went out, got bid up. I think it IPO'd at like in the 50s, it went all the way up to 140. As time goes by, investors are going to get smarter. The AI play is real, but they're going to stick to the shovels and the picks and the Microns and Long, NVIDIA Long, those, and they're going to move away, I think, from the periphery that are derivative AI plays.
And that's what we've seen so far. I mean, software has been a laggard, hasn't really received that kind of rally.
Nor should it. Although Apple is a sneaky AI play. Again, long that.
They've got their conference coming up in June.
June 10th.
Which will be interesting. Last question for you. So where are you looking now? And we had Trey Stevens on from Founders Fund. He's looking at defense tech, hardware. That's sort of similar where you're looking.
I saw that. Right, I'm a co-founder of a company called Performance Drone Works. There are two really important areas that the United States must focus on, and that is building small UAS drones and electronic warfare. That's what Ukraine is showing us. So in the Valley of Death, it's very real, very hard for defense companies to get funded. So I've worked personally as the co-founder for years to build this technology, the single most versatile small drone in the world, and also dealing with electronic warfare.
And you're seeing more government contracts go to the smaller startups too.
They are.
Right?
It's very easy to get a government contract to do research. It's very hard to scale. That is still the challenge in the United States. A lot of these companies go to die in the Valley of Death, and so more money needs to flow into the space.
Great distinction. Thanks for being with us, Matt Higgins, RSC Ventures. We're getting some headlines from Kansas City Fed President Jeff Schmidt. Steve Leisman has the story.
Deirdre, thanks very much. Yeah, Jeff Schmidt, one of the newest members of the Federal Market Committee, the Kansas City Fed, who took office in August, saying it's appropriate for policy to remain restrictive at this time. He is citing a tight labor market, above trend growth, and inflation running above 2% as reasons to stay on hold. Says the Fed should wait for clear and convincing evidence inflation is headed to 2%. Policy should be patient, he says, not preemptive in cutting rates. Inflation, he says, a surprise to the upside this year. He cites a 4% annual rate for inflation in the first quarter. He's concerned about inflation with, from among other things, a slower improvement in supply chains, which helped inflation a lot last year. Among the risks he cited is the returns of goods inflation. It was negative in the report this week, but that is, he's concerned about global shipping disruptions and the high prices of energy. He cites the labor market tightness, resilience to high rates from the economy. He says that makes the path of policy more uncertain, and job gains potentially driving up housing inflation. There is some good news in all this. He talks about the rebound in immigration having helped ease labor market tightness. That's a good sign. He says inflation has stepped down significantly and the economy is growing well above trend. The trouble with that, Deirdre, is it's that well above trend growth that makes him wary about cutting interest rates. So interesting to note, the reason I wanted to log this in, it's only the second speech he's given on the economy since taking office. And we're wondering if he follows in what is a tradition at the Kansas City Fed of a more hawkish than average president, usually from Kansas City.
Absolutely. Steve Leisman, thanks for bringing that to us. And I'll just note that markets are still close to session lows. The Dow is down about 560 points. And with rates spiking and the dollar strengthening, it's also not a great day for international equities. Seema Modi is here with more. Seema, what are you seeing?
Andy, it wasn't just the U.S. markets that were hoping for an interest rate cut this year. The international world was also betting on rates dropping and bringing down the cost of capital. Most emerging markets, again, are still sitting on dollar-denominated debt. So when rates are higher and the dollar firms up, it gets more expensive for these countries to pay off that debt. Citi's global team writing this morning that while emerging market central banks can still cut rates even with the Fed on hold, a regime of higher U.S. rates for the foreseeable future, that's very difficult for these nations. We also saw overnight disappointing economic data from China yet again, with exports falling more than expected for the month of March. So you saw Chinese equities underperform. And even names like Alibaba and Baidu, Deidre, you're seeing those names down about 3 to 4%. Separately, there was a note from Daiwa Markets. That's the Japanese-based research firm that wrote a note saying that they're bringing down their earnings projections for Alibaba, which you can see that stock down as well right now.
Interesting. Just as Jack Ma comes back with a memo to employees, maybe a little bit of cold water there. Seema, we've been talking about sort of the narrative changing a little bit in the Chinese economy, right, with growth getting a little better. What impact are higher interest rates going to have here in the U.S.?
Yeah, well, similarly for other countries, I think higher interest rates do make the cost of capital a lot higher and tougher for these countries to pay off. So clearly, in this type of environment, if we do see higher interest rates for a prolonged period of time, it's a change in expectations for these countries and investors who have been pricing in a Fed rate cut. That's, of course, something that China has to think about as well.
Absolutely. Thank you. Key dynamic here, Seema Modi. We're sticking with international markets. Robert Frank joins me now with a look at the wealthy and passport portfolios. And this is actually key because it plays a lot into consumption, right? A lot of Chinese want different passports so that they can go and buy luxury goods in other places.
That's right. And it works the other way, too. A lot of Americans going over to Europe and buying things there, including real estate. So if you look at what's happening, a record number of Americans are now getting second passports to hedge their risk. According to Henley & Partners, the U.S. is now the largest market for applications for multiple passports and long-term visas. The American wealthy aren't giving up their American citizenship. They're just adding a second or sometimes third or fourth. They're called passport portfolios. And just like stocks, they're designed to hedge your financial risk over multiple countries. Some cite politics or social unrest. Others, they like second passports for safer business travel, especially to countries that may be a little hostile to the U.S.
And the idea of diversification is very well understood by wealthy individuals around what I invest into, but then it makes no sense to have one country of citizenship and residence when I have the ability to actually diversify that aspect of my life as well.
So where are they going? Well, America's favorite countries for second passports are Portugal, not a surprise there, beautiful country, Malta, Greece, and Italy. Globally, a record number of millionaires are expected to migrate this year, mainly, as Dee just said, out of China, Russia, and some other hotspots. The U.S. still has a net inflow of millionaires with an expected 3,500 millionaires coming to the U.S.
I was just going to ask you if that worked the other way around, wanting passports here. I've lived abroad for a long time before I came here, and people complained about their U.S. passports. Granted, they were in there's a lot of benefits to it, but global taxation, that's one reason to sort of not hold a U.S. passport. But you're saying that people in China and Russia, the benefits outweigh that.
Yeah, we're one of the only countries in the world that taxes your global income no matter where you live and work. So you may not have been in the U.S. for 20 years, but if you're a U.S. citizen, you have to file a return. So that's a big problem. But for many of these people in these other countries where the rule of law has sort of fallen apart, they may be out of odds with the government. The U.S. is a safer place for their money. So you're just getting a massive migration all over, just a remix around the world of wealth just moving to other countries.
Yeah.
And the U.S., it's really just a hedge.
It's like a tax on security. So
exactly.
Perhaps worth
exactly.
It. Robert Frank, thank you very much.
Thank
and
you.
For more of Robert's stories following the money of global wealth, you can sign up for his weekly Inside Wealth newsletter by scanning that QR code on your screen or going to cnbc.com/insidewealth. Do sign up for it. It's a great newsletter. And coming up, forget experiences or quiet luxury items. Groceries are what millennials and Gen Z are spending on these days. We're going to dig into what's driving the supermarket splurges and the companies benefiting next. And here is another check on stocks. The Dow, industrials was down as much as 580 points. You can see now it's come off of those lows. The NASDAQ is still the underperformer and the 10-year has dipped below 4.5%. Welcome back. We continue to monitor the sell-off in equities. Meanwhile, new data from CNBC and the National Retail Federation showing a bounce back in consumer spending despite rates staying higher for longer. Steve Leisman joins me now with that story. Steve.
Thanks, Deirdre. Yeah, consumers continue to spend moderately strongly in March spending. That looks even better if you consider that inflation in the consumer goods sector is flat and even in some categories negative. CNBC NRF Monitor, we get real credit card data from Affinity. We crunch it. We come up with 0.4 on the month. Same gains as last month, which were a little bit noisy because of the leap day. We took that out for the comparison purposes. Year over year, still at 2.7, pretty good numbers there. And then the month over month came down. It's not even quite 0.2 to 0.3. It's 0.23 versus 0.27. So not much of a decline there. The year over year did come down. It's still a pretty strong number, 2.9% from 3 in February. The history shows considerable volatility over the past month, but spending has now bounced back. You see here, we had this negative number in January, made economists worried, hey, that long-awaited consumer slowdown was coming. It didn't. We've had 2 months now of gains. So that seems to be a little bit off the off the charts now, this idea that at least at the beginning of the year, we've seen this again. Part of this has been, by the way, it's helped us helped push up Q1 GDP forecast. The breakdown by sector shows even results here. Six up, six down here, the top three bottom. Non-store retailers, that's your internet folks, up 2.5%. Food and beverage strong. Sporting goods and hobbies, that's a good number because that's a discretionary area. Then you got housing-related stuff that is negative, has been negative. Electronic and maybe appliances as part of that housing thing. We've also had some deflation in that number right there. Take a look, despite higher overall inflation, goods inflation has been flat to negative in 8 of the past 12 months, suggesting consumers looking for, what would you call it, value. And in a competitive market, the government reported that this morning that prices for consumer goods, imports, ex-autos fell. So on the input side, Deirdre, yeah, when it comes to if you're a retailer, your input of stuff, but not input of labor. Input of stuff prices are going down, but you still have these rising input of labor costs, places where perhaps the minimum wage went up, could be driving prices as well. So we'll see.
There's another piece of this, and that is services inflation, right? We heard Larry Fink talk about that this morning, and he was saying that is the hardest part to bring down. And that maybe we're not paying enough attention to that.
Well, I think we're paying plenty of attention to it, which is the concern over the inflation numbers we had. In other words, if you were not paying enough attention to it, you would not have freaked out on Wednesday with the CPI. And you would have been, you would have had a major rally on Thursday with the PPI because those input costs came down. The market is very attuned to service inflation. The Fed is very attuned to service inflation. That seems to be Schmidt just talking from Kansas City, pegging the idea that service inflation is being driven by tightness in the labor market. Perhaps you saw it, by the way, in that food and beverage number, which went up 1.2%. Remember, those numbers are not inflation corrected. So some of the places we saw gains could be gains in prices rather than gains in volume.
Okay, well, Steve Liesman, thanks for bringing that to us.
Pleasure.
Appreciate it. Speaking of consumer spending, Amazon coming off its first new all-time high since July 2021, nearly doubling in the past 12 months. In his annual letter to shareholders, CEO Andy Jassy says that he is committed to cutting costs while simultaneously investing in artificial intelligence. Not an easy thing to do with so much uncertainty in the macro environment, but here's what he told Andrew Ross Sorkin about the health of the economy on Squawk Box yesterday.
Consumers are spending, they're just trading down. You know, we a place where we see it real impact is, you know, in discretionary items, things like TVs or computers or electronics. You know, we're growing our market segment share at a faster rate there than others, but still at a lower rate than what we see in a healthy economy.
For more from that interview and to read Jassy's full letter to shareholders, go to CNBC.com. Let's take a look now at where younger consumers are spending. And a new McKinsey study shows millennials and Gen Z spending on groceries is poised to outpace restaurants, travel, apparel, even fitness. Joining me now to take a deeper dive into the latest Gen Z trends is Casey Lewis, the founder of the After School newsletter. Casey, that took me by surprise that they're spending on groceries.
Yeah, I think it's all about these status groceries. You know, they're small luxuries. They don't cost a ton. They can Instagram about them. They can TikTok about them. So not only do they taste good, but there's the sort of flex element that they bring.
So they're not spending at Erewhon. They're going to some of the larger chains. Is that right?
Yeah, I mean, I think Erewhon, the LA teens probably are, but otherwise it's, you know, it's these sort of like the idea of the Shopee shop, the New York Magazine story, these sort of indie labels. These like fancy little spices and things like that. When I was a teen, I wasn't buying fancy spices, but it's a different time.
Interesting. So we just heard from Andy Jassy, the CEO of Amazon, who has a great pulse on the consumer. And he said that they're trading down and This sort of phenomenon that's entered the U.S. over the last year or so has been the rise of the Chinese e-commerce players, Temu and Shein. And it's funny, even my eight-year-old talks about shopping on Temu more than he does Amazon. Where's this headed?
It's crazy. There's a new Piper Sandler study that top five retailers among teens, Amazon is number one. Shein and Temu is on that list of the top five for the first time ever. So I think what you're seeing in your own household is very consistent with young people's shopping behaviors. But the thing is, young people don't have a lot of money to spend. So the Sheins and the Temu, they can get a lot for not very much if it's bad for the world.
Here's another thing. Young people really like games and gaming, and that is what Shein and Temu really play on. I mean, when you go to the site, the first thing it asks you to do is spin a wheel for discounts. I wonder, did they get something there that American e-commerce companies haven't been able to take advantage of? And how sustainable is that? I mean, you can only imagine they're burning through tons of money to offer those kinds of discounts.
Yeah, I mean, I think the gamification of shopping is a little bit scary when you think about it. And I don't think it's sustainable, but it's fun while it lasts.
Certainly, I guess. Then you can get some really cheap things. Talk a little bit about TikTok, because again, you know, that was sort of the first Chinese company to gain a real audience in the U.S. and you've seen others follow. But I can see that it's dropped off a little bit.
Yeah, I mean, and to bring it back to shopping for a second, I think we're seeing with TikTok Shop as well, the sort of gamification of shopping, and they make it so easy where you don't even have to leave the app. But I do think it's interesting to see TikTok have fallen off of the Piper Sandler list a bit, and Instagram have it's making strides. Instagram was not looking good 6 months ago even, and now it's number two. So we're really seeing these shifts in real time.
Yeah, absolutely. Casey, wonderful to get your insights. Thank you very much.
Thank you so much.
Let's get a quick news alert. U.S. Steel announcing that its shareholders have just voted in favor of Nippon Steel's $14 billion acquisition of the company. We will continue to track that story. Shares there are down about 2.6%. And before we go, let's also just get a check on the markets, because we have seen session lows this hour. The Dow Industrials is still down by about 500 points, as you can see on your screen. The S&P 500 down 1.5%. The NASDAQ still the laggard here, but should note that the 10-year yield has dipped below 4.5. We'll continue to track that in the next hour. Power Lunch is up next. I'll join Tyler on the other side of this quick break.
You've been listening to The Exchange. Make sure you're subscribed to get each episode every day, same time, same place.
This podcast is supported by FedEx. Dear small and medium businesses, no one wants happy customers more than you do. So you need a business partner just like you, like FedEx, who understands your passion for serving your customers because they have the same commitment towards you. That's why FedEx offers you picture proof of delivery, packageless and paperless returns, as well as weekend home delivery to 98% of the U.S. on Saturday and 50% on Sunday. See the FedEx service guide for delivery information. What's more, FedEx Ground is faster to more locations than UPS Ground. Trust FedEx for timely deliveries. See what FedEx can do for your business. Absolutely, positively FedEx.